Welcome to Pardon the Corruption. Today, my guest is Sarah Khalil from the Raptor Queens podcast. She is the host of the podcast, and she's kind enough to join us to talk about a bunch of things, but most notably, the road trip that just ended with the Raptors going 1-3. You know, a lot of moral victories on that road trip, but only one real victory, as Andrew Damelin in his post so eloquently put it this morning. Tuesday.
Yeah.
So let's start off with the main talking point, which is the Pascal Siakam's resurgence. I mean, he had been struggling for a bit, and people were down on him, and people seem to go down on him very, very quickly. Have you noticed that it doesn't take a lot for people to really, really hammer Pascal Siakam?
Yeah, I think that's true. And you know, there's some merit to the negativity that there has been around him. I think especially because last year we saw him just explode out the gate, and really everyone should have just been counting their blessings that he performed as well as he did and at the level that he was performing at. You know, the dip in the playoffs, there are so many reasons why that could have happened. And I understand that Raptors fans were disappointed and would have preferred that the outcome of the Boston series was different. And there was a lot to, you know, look at for Pascal as to why we didn't win. But I feel like the ongoing negativity isn't warranted, and that there's an integration period when a player is learning new skills and playing a different role on the team. So that's my take on it. Yeah, I think people are overly down on him and made a decision too early about what he's capable of. I don't think we've fully seen it yet.
Yeah, I agree. And I think I made the point last night after the game against the Blazers that, you know, this is a guy who is taking on the mantle of the leader of the team. Mm-hmm. It's his second season entering that role. And last season was heavily interrupted with COVID, and he didn't touch a basketball for like whatever it is, like 40 yeah. years or whatever it was. So it's really harsh to judge him in really short bursts. It's almost like on a game by game basis, we are like constantly judging him. And it's fair to evaluate a player, but when he struggles, it just seems like there's an exponential reaction to his bad play and a linear reaction to his good play, right? So, it was good to see him come back strong on the road trip. Where are you on the Pascal Siakam? I'm comfortable with him as my number one guy, my cornerstone franchise player. I know a lot of people are on different points of that spectrum. Where are you on that one?
Interesting question. I am comfortable. Oh, okay. So I think the Raptors team is still Kyle's team. Like that Kyle still holds the heart of the team. I think it makes sense if you look at a skills perspective and what can happen, what each player can bring, that Pascal is your number one option. But I still think that there's like an edge or an ownership that he would need to take over from Kyle for it to really become his team. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's how it's going to go. It might also become Fred's team. You know, we'll see how it goes in terms of leadership. But regardless of who's the captain of the team or who's leading the team vocally, what I still want to see from Pascal is a killer instinct. Mm-hmm. So that in those clutch moments, like he's showing that he can perform throughout the course of a game. And it's those last plays in the final quarter, the game-winning plays, where it just seems like he hasn't quite adopted the mentality of I will win this game, whatever it takes. Mm-hmm. And so that's the piece that I think there's still an area for growth.
Is that a function of time, or is that a function of like his skill development? Because it's normal to think that players like him require some time to develop those skills, and especially, you know, like, yeah, he's been in the league for a little bit now, but you know, I don't think he's had the focus of defenses up until last year. So mm-hmm. I think it takes a little bit of time for him to adjust to what defenses are throwing at him. So for example, like in the game, the shot that he missed against Golden State. I mean, I don't think that was the number one move that the Raptors wanted to play on that, but they were hedging him hard. They were closing out from the sides. It was left to him to like read the game. And maybe it's that reading of the game that takes more time. And then you combine that with skill development. It's like a confluence of factors coming in towards his development. And we're kind of seeing like all the rivers kind of meeting and heading into the ocean, and it's causing a ripple, which people are not used to seeing, because they're, I don't know what people are used to seeing, but they certainly seem to be very disappointed when Siakam does anything wrong.
Yeah. And as a perfect example of this idea of integration and then taking the next leap, Pascal had 10 assists, and his assists and game making over the course of the season has dramatically improved. And to me, part of the learning curve includes the downward portion. A learning curve typically is not like this. It's often, okay, I got really good at doing what I knew how to do, and now I have to learn a new skill. And it actually requires me to break down what I already knew. And I think that's the dip that we witnessed. And now he's bringing it all together, adding all these pieces, integrating them, and we're seeing more of this upward, you know, curve. And to your question, do I think it's time, skill? I think it's both. And then I think the part I'm talking about is really specifically deciding to adopt a mentality. Mm-hmm. And Pascal plays with a lot of joy and a lot of emotion. And I think the emotion I would have him add is killer instinct, whatever that emotion
is. It's an intangible,
is.
Right? It's an intangible. It's hard to pin down.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wish all Raptors had that Kobe mentality from day one. And that mm-hmm. that kind of takes time to develop. Did you notice
Fred's
anything
kind of
particular
like
on the West Coast trip?
Sorry, go ahead.
Did you notice anything particular on the West Coast trip that he did differently to get his offense? Because he was much more efficient overall than he had been in the past. So any observations on your end on there?
Well, this is not going to be a very technical observation, but it's my favorite analogy. It's kind of cheesy, but I'm going with it. It was in the game against Phoenix. He had a series of plays. One was a dunk. Another was on the fast break coming in and just like Euro stepping around somebody it was just this classic Pascal moment. And my experience of watching it was I felt like I sneezed, and I felt like I've been waiting to sneeze for 8 months. And I was just like, oh, yes, he finally did it. And since that moment, he's been playing great. And so for me, this is not technical at all, but I am calling Pascal's emergence the sneeze. And feel free to adopt that and tell all your listeners that they can take it too.
Yeah, no, I know exactly the play you're talking about, because I was watching the Phoenix feed for that game. And when he made that move, the Phoenix announcers, they called it a travel, because I don't think they understood what a Eurostep is.
Right. Yeah.
And that was my reaction. I was like, what? That's not a travel by any means.
Yeah. And it was just fast. It was explosive. And I just had this moment. I'm like, oh my God, he's back. There he is. It's great.
It was decisive, right? I mean, he was more decisive. He was more quick with his decision making. And also, I like to give credit to Nick Nurse a little for actually running the offense through Pascal a lot more. And even in the last couple of games that we ended up losing, our poor stretches really coincided with the Raptors going away from Pascal as a centerpiece of the offense and trying to run their offense through different guys. When he was on the floor, whether it be with the ball or whether it be on the block looking for passes or posting up, the Raptors fared fairly well.
Yeah, and credit to Pascal for really taking the time to learn how to read defenses.
Yeah.
Because his ability to wait for the double team before mm-hmm. making the pass, like there are still some turnovers that he's making when the double team comes and trying to, you know, force passes through a whole bunch of defenders, significantly less than what we saw at the end of last season. So I'm encouraged, really encouraged actually even though they lost, I don't know. Yeah. I was happy watching the last four games.
What do you say to, because this was the talking point, even though he had strong games, this was the talking point coming out of the two games, was that like Pascal's not clutch, right? What do you say to somebody who is adamant in that opinion that this guy doesn't know how to play the fourth quarter or doesn't know how to finish a game? What is your reaction? Like if you were like, I'm asking this question, like what's your reaction to people? Because yesterday we did our first live stream after a game, and it was a bit of a disaster technically and all that, but there were a bunch of people in the comments stream that really were hitting him for not being a clutch player.
Yeah. So my reaction is to two things. One, I think they're right for now, but I don't think that is a verdict about who he is forever. What it seems like is that Nick Nurse is deliberately putting the ball back into his hands, knowing that he's not necessarily going to be able to get it, and deciding on purpose to train him for those moments. Now, this might come back to this like killer instinct idea, because you have, you know, legends like Michael Jordan who always hit your clutch shots, et cetera. And I do think there's a mentality that comes with it, where you just, the ball's in your hands, you want the ball in your hands, and you would never give it up to anyone else. And I think this is what I'm talking about with ownership, is that the fact that there's even a question that it might go to someone other than Pascal tells me that he's not actually the clutch player yet. Mm-hmm. Like, should it go to someone else? That is even a question. He's not a clutch player yet.
Yeah.
But I'm willing to say that he could be.
Yeah. And I'd say to become a clutch player, the number one thing you have to do first is actually be willing to take the shot.
Yeah.
Forget about making it. I mean, even going ahead and taking on the responsibility of winning the game with like 10 seconds to go and wanting the ball in that situation, that shows that he's willing to be in high risk, high pressure situations, and he's going to miss some shots. And, you know, like, given that the season is not really about winning a title or even like doing anything special, if it's not for the development of exactly these kind of players, what the hell is it for?
Exactly. And you know what? The rest of the team, it seems to me, does still want him to be taking these shots. And so we're not seeing any kind of, we're not hearing about anyway, any tension or conflict from any of the other players saying that it should have been me or why is our coach doing this. And so to me, that the fact that he has buy-in from the team is actually the most important part of this, of this element. I don't think as much as buy-in from the fans, we think we're really important, but you know, like we're not actually on the court playing the game and developing these players. So.
So we'd be remiss not to talk about Chris Boucher, who really made a name for himself on the road trip. I mentioned this in just some people a couple of days back, is that it was Andrew Damelin who wrote the post-game report this morning for us. 2 years ago, he told me, watch out for Chris Boucher. And he described one characteristic of the guy, because he covers the 905 pretty deeply, and he knows a lot about it. And he goes, this guy is not scared of anything. He is fearless. It doesn't matter who he's going up against. It could be a guy who's like 80 pounds bigger than him or whatever it is. His attitude and approach to the game is exactly the same. He's fearless. He does not get moved by the occasion. And anytime you hear that kind of description of a guy, you kind of know that he's going to find himself, because he's got the skill level there. He's got the length, like 7 blocks in a game, consistent 3-point shooting overall. I know he surprised you. How much has he surprised you?
Oh, man. Well, okay. First of all, it makes me emotional when I hear you talk about his courage and his fearlessness, because like, it's just so apparent, and it's wonderful. It inspires me. But I do remember the very first time I ever saw him shoot a 3-point shot. I remember my thought was, oh no, what are we watching? Why is he allowed to shoot the ball? Because what is that form? So, you know, in some ways I'm surprised every single time that shot goes in, because I can't believe that it is an effective mechanism to get the ball in the hoop. So just that by itself is surprising, but you know, like, am I surprised at how far he's come? I'm not at all surprised by the intensity that he brings to the court. Maybe I am surprised by how effective he's been despite his size this season. I know he's had extended minutes, so we obviously expected some uptick in productivity, but
He really has claimed that center spot, which was up for grabs at the start of the season. And there was some, like, you know, there was some debate, you know, like, people, Baines is probably going to start, and you signed Lan, and Boucher, with his lack of experience, maybe was even being slotted as the third option in some rotations. So to see him see that softness in our rotation and just grab it and take the opportunity is just fantastic to watch. And it's not, and you know, it's not like he's a liability at any point on the floor. It's not like you're giving anything up by putting him in. With every other guy on the center spot, whether it be Baines or Len, with Len, you're giving up, well, pretty much everything. With Baines, you're giving up also pretty much everything. But with Boucher, you're actually a plus in most categories that you care about as a center. And that to me is just fascinating because this guy has gone two levels up in one off season.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I still think the rebounding is a problem for the Raptors. Yeah. And I also think it would be unfair to put that all on Chris Boucher's shoulders. It's not actually the right role for him to play to be the team's key rebounder. He does a great job, especially offensively on putbacks, considering the role that he has. And so, you know, I think your comment that you don't give anything up is in comparison to gains and wins.
Yeah,
in comparison to a traditional, you know, big guy, perhaps you do. And that's for the front office and maybe the coaching staff to either develop Baines and Len or to trade for a big piece. But I would not fault Chris Boucher on any aspect of his game right now, especially with the roster that the Raptors have. Just credit. I have nothing but like wonderful things to say about him and the energy and intensity and fire that he's bringing to every shift. That guy has no low gear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's great.
You brought up, you alluded to kind of lack of rebounding and lack of size, or not lack of everything in the front court positions. Where do you stand on the idea of actually filling that gap this year, knowing that you will probably not be getting marquee players in return? You probably be get somebody with a limited amount of upside. You might get like a starter, but a starter who's really at the, like, it's like a mid-level exception type of guy you might get, but you'd be giving up assets that you might be able to package in the offseason for something or a part of a larger trade. Is the need to fill that center position urgent to you, or are you willing to kind of ride the season out and see where you go with these three?
I would go somewhere in the middle. I don't think it's urgent in the sense that it will make a significant difference for a title run. I don't think we're missing one key piece, and then if we get it, we're contenders.
Yeah.
At least there are no key pieces available that would be the difference maker in my mind. That said, do we have to wait till the end of the season to make a good trade? I don't think so. And so to me, if the opportunity arises and the right players become available for the right price, whatever that is, I would not hesitate to pull the trigger at all. And I hope that Nasai and Bobby are looking and considering what can be done.
Yeah. But by the way, I love how we like two Raptor fans are talking about title runs when we're 2-8.
I know. It's because they're not as bad as 2-8. But at the same thing, but the gaps are huge. Like there's just no room for error on a roster that basically has five consistently good players and then one consistently inconsistent player who is good. That's Norm, in case you're wondering who I'm talking about. And then a bench that you just at the moment can't contribute what you need offensively.
Yeah.
So
let's talk. So Norm is interesting because he's always been like our trade bait, you know, like it's always been like, oh yeah, we're going to throw in Norm. We're going to get that guy. We're going to do this and like throw in Norm in there. Right. You know, and while his value is just like declining sharp, right. Like he's like freaking Intel stock. Where are you in the fade for Cade movement? And it is growing. And as these losses pile up, like if we lose both these games to Charlotte coming up, like you're gonna see a hashtag happening if it hasn't happened already on just going and trying to tank and go. And what is your view on tanking as a strategy overall? Pros and cons. Where do you stand on that? Especially given this season's context and the 2-8 record. I think I know the answer, but.
Oh, really? Do you want to guess my answer?
Well, I think you just said that the Raptors aren't as bad as their record is, so I could extrapolate on that one and project your answer, but...
Okay. This is so personal and probably not actually about being a good basketball manager, and probably there's a reason I'm not a basketball manager. I really value authenticity. So if the Raptors authentically tank, I'm down. no problem. Like, if they're going to do it and do it for real and get behind that, then great. I don't think that Fred or Kyle or Boucher have it in them to authentically throw a season, and that that would be far more harmful to the team in the short and long run than just playing the best they can. And if, you know, if the best they can is last this season, okay. But at least it was authentic and true to themselves. Masai, same thing. Like, can you honestly and authentically see Masai telling his team to not win? I mean, maybe that's what he did by, you know, losing Surge. That was, but not on purpose, right? Like, yeah. At least I don't think that was on purpose. Otherwise, he's playing chess, and I don't even know what move he's on. But
well, there is precedent for him trying to sort of tank, because he did try to trade Kyle Lowry to the Knicks way back in December of whatever that year was. So he did. It was the Wiggins year, and he did try to do it until Dolan had got cold feet and went back. So there is, but that's pre-championship. I don't know how much a person's mind changes after a championship. So who knows? But yeah. That's a great point. I mean, authentic tanking is like, if you're going to do it like Philly, like, you know, trust the process, make a 5-year plan of being bad, not this 1-year, like, quick fix tanking. Come on.
You know what? This is such a strange year. Like, if there was a year where you're going to tank, like, I kind of would like it to be this year, because it's a bit of a asterisk season. It's a bit of a throwaway. We don't even know what's going to happen in terms of player availability on a game by game basis. So like, how much does this season really matter? But I just don't see Kyle and Fred being like, okay, yeah, no problem. We're just not going to compete. I just don't see it.
Do you feel a little, like, I find myself a little emotionally detached watching the games this year? Like,
because if you emotionally attach, you feel sad?
Maybe it's like a preventive mechanism of like self-defense. I don't know what it is, but it could just be that exactly what you said, is that this season does not really have a shining light at the end of it.
Right.
So you may as well just take what you can get. And like, whenever these losses happen, usually I'd be like crushed after like 2 1-point losses. Right. But my reaction to that really was, yeah, well, you know, he's learning, and, you know, we got something out of it. It was a good game to watch, entertaining. He got better. Like, the reaction seems to be very different than previous years. I don't know what that, maybe I'm getting old. I don't know, but whatever it is, it's different.
Yeah, I mean, you're definitely getting older, but that's the case with everyone, so don't worry about it.
That's how time works, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
So
I'm still emotionally attached, but
let's move to some other guys. Nick Nurse again. We'll go in. People seem to have like early on in the season, there was a lot of calling for Matt Thomas to play a lot of minutes,
and he died.
And you know, Nick Nurse was being called stubborn, but since then he's really gone deep into the bench with Malachi Flynn, Terrence Davis, Stanley Johnson's getting some minutes. You know, Norm Powell obviously is coming off the bench. Now that you've seen a bit of everybody, save for maybe Matt Thomas and what's the guy's name, Bembry, you've sort of seen most of the guys there. Is there anybody that you're like, that player has sort of made a name for himself and gotten his name into the rotation a little bit more permanently?
Yeah, I think you have to look to Stanley Johnson as being that person who, I mean, last year we made a joke that Stanley was the bubble MVP because of that one final game where he just went off and had this great game. And so, but that was a joke. I was not expecting extended minutes from Stanley this year. And so clearly he has impressed the coaching staff. And to be honest, he's impressed me. I think defensively, here's what I've noticed about who's getting playing time and who, in my opinion, rightly is not. Maybe Matt Thomas, I'm not entirely sure, but like Len and Aaron Baines, and why they're not getting playing time compared to why Stanley is, to me, is because Stanley's actually playing at the right speed, and that he's not this piece that's half a step too slow. And I look at Aaron Baines, and to me, the reason he can't catch Lowry's pass is because the Raptors play too fast for him. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's because of, you know, how long has Stanley with the team? 3 years?
Well, he's been playing for maybe two, but he was on bench. He was injured 1 year, right?
Yeah. So he's had this extended practice time with the Raptors. And I think where he's benefited is that he knows how fast the Raptors play. Yeah. And that's what I like to look at when I see even Yuta Watanabe coming off the bench. I think he's fast and that the game isn't too fast for him. Mm-hmm. So that's encouraging. I think that, of course, there's still like skills that need to be developed on the bench and that there's just like so much more development potential. That's my nice way of saying that.
Yeah. No, Stanley Johnson is a good call out. And I think defensively, he is definitely ahead of maybe Davis, but Davis is too sporadic and too inconsistent defensively to really be in that category.
I actually think that Stanley Johnson is more consistent on defense than Norm. I think Stanley's head is in the game consistently this year in particular. Like, he's grateful for the opportunity that he has, and whatever he had to learn to get off the bench, it seems to me like he learned it.
Yeah. And you see that sometimes people get a chance to sit on the sidelines and observe the game and think about it, knowing that they don't have to worry about playing time because they're injured or whatever. So you get a chance to just kind of detach yourself from the game and just observe and see what other people are doing. And then when it comes time for you to play, there's a lot you can take into the game after having been out of it, right? There's that element of it too, maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. The NBA announced some new COVID protocols. I honestly don't know how to I have no idea how to contain this disease or anything about it. But so now they've kind of banned like shoot arounds are limited. You can't bump on the free throw line. You got to wear masks at certain times and on certain chairs. It's a bit of a hodgepodge of a mess. And they're doing this because they really don't want to lose games, because I think for every game on Turner, I think it's like $3.5 million, $4 million revenue for the TV companies. And they obviously don't want to mess with it.
Yeah.
Do you think the NBA, first of all, will be able to finish the season? Because there were already some rumblings of interruptions or pauses in play. Like, what's your view of this entire thing and just COVID in general and how the NBA came back?
So my first thought is I'm really glad I'm not Adam Silver. That would just be the worst job to have. I don't think there's a definitively right answer. Mm-hmm. The black and white way to approach it is don't play. Mm-hmm. Life is rarely black and white. So what are you going to do? You have to balance so many interests. I imagine they're doing the best job that they think they can, or like they think they're doing the best job they can. And I don't know if the season will finish. Maybe that's the Raptors' grand plan, and maybe that's why they were so like, meh, for the first few games. Just what's the point? Yeah.
I mean, it's a tough topic to even discuss because there's so many unknowns into this thing, and we're not privy to like information that goes into decision making. But when you see players getting COVID left and right, and Kyrie having parties and videotaping them for some reason, which makes no sense whatsoever. There's a video out there with him with his family, and he's in trouble with the Nets for doing that. A lot of things. So, I mean, if I look at the rate of spread and I look at that, really there's no, in the bubble, you were in the bubble, you had no options, and now you can do basically whatever you want, really. There's no policing. I would be shocked if the NBA doesn't at some point just pause play. Hopefully not, but I'm just saying that could be it.
I wouldn't be surprised if they did. Maybe that's my flip of what you just said.
Yeah, it's a difficult topic, as I said. Let's put this one into bed. By the way, Ontario in a lockdown, and I know you're in BC. What's the situation there? Is it lockdown there? How are you guys dealing with it?
No, we have some restrictions. Rolling case averages, I think, are around 500 a day, which is plateaued and coming down from the beginning of December. Mm-hmm. So that's good. Yeah, there are restrictions on social gatherings, but restaurants are still open. Malls, I don't know. I don't think we're in the same position as a lot of other provinces. Yeah. So we're fortunate.
So let's pick up on the BC thread a little.
Sure.
We talked a little bit over text about the Vancouver Grizzlies and how you were a Raptor fan living in Calgary.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing the Grizzlies were around when you were a Raptor fan, or?
Yeah, they were. I never particularly followed the Grizzlies because I was just super hardcore about the Raptors. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like I still walk around. I see people wearing Bibby jerseys or... big guy. I'm blanking.
Bryant Reeves.
Yeah. Bryant Reeves. They've got his jerseys walking around. So, I mean, there's still like a love for basketball in this city. And I think people wish we had a team still or again.
How's the, have you noticed like how the coverage of the sport has changed in Calgary over the years? Cause I can tell you like when I came to Canada in 1995 or around that time, I remember being a big basketball fan and looking for sports coverage of the Raptors or basketball in general, and it was zilch, right? Yeah. It's etched in my brain. I remember just tuning into the Fan 590 Sportsnet, and every 20 minutes they used to give like sports updates, like this team beat that team. It was mostly NHL, but they used to give the NBA scores as well, like you know the Knicks beat the Heat or whatever, and I remember being shocked when during the sports update, they did not even bother announcing which two NBA teams played. And they just said the winners from the NBA included the Knicks, Bucks, Lakers. And I'm like, yeah, but who did they beat and by how much? Right. So and I was like, God damn, man. Like, what was Calgary something like that? Or was it this is Toronto in mid 90s? What was the Calgary experience like trying to be a basketball fan there?
Yeah. So it was, is the game on TV? So that was a question. Like, could we actually watch it? Yeah. I think that's about as much as I can say. Now I don't ask if the game's on TV. At least I know that it will be. And I don't know. I was a kid. We would just cheer for the Raptors in my basement.
Okay.
And it was great.
I think I'm showing my age difference here in the last couple of questions. Okay.
Oh, sorry, man.
Let's talk a little bit about, before we round up, about your podcast, Raptor Sure. Queens. When did it start? What motivated it? How did it come about?
Yeah, well, so the Raptor Queens podcast is the first ever all-woman podcast that covers the Toronto Raptors. Really how it came about was because of Twitter. I think it was, I actually can't remember who tweeted it now. I think it was @NopeName, tweeted something like, oh, wouldn't it be great if there was an all-woman podcast for the Raptors? Who would want to do that? Mm-hmm. And then I was like, I would love to. That would be amazing. And then a bunch of people responded. I ended up getting in touch with them. We were like, okay, well, I guess we're doing it. So that was a year ago in December. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we're on season two. I think we've recorded something like 45 or 50 episodes, weekly coverage. It's great.
Yeah. And now there are two, because there's also Dishes and Dimes, which is...
That's right. Yeah. So the same person who originally tweeted is actually part of it. Little did I know that I think they actually had a plan to launch an all-woman podcast. And I just wasn't aware that they were probably doing it. And I was like, oh, I have to make sure someone does this. And so I kind of like took it upon myself to make sure it happened. Meanwhile, they were doing it as well. So it's great. I'm happy that they're in the space and yeah, they're awesome.
I've listened to both and definitely a different perspective on both.
Totally different styles.
Than what the stuff is out there, which is a really welcome sign because a lot of it is just, it is fascinatingly different. And I really enjoy whenever I do tune in.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, one of the things that I would say is characteristic of our podcast is we're really in a conversation more than a debate. Even when there's questions like a yes or no question, we're rarely going to, be fighting each other or yelling at each other, which I think is what they do, on TNT and ESPN for ratings. Mm-hmm. But you won't find that on our podcast.
ESPN has become essentially unwatchable for me.
Right? It's annoying.
I think I've mentioned this before, that one of my favorite channels ever was Headline Sports, which was what later became The Score TV. And it was all highlights, 24/7, no human being. You never saw a person. You only saw highlights, and you saw the background voice calling the highlights. And that guy used to be Sid Sixero. I think I'm pretty sure he was one of the guys who was commentating on the highlights. And to me, that remains to date the best sports channel I have ever seen. And I'm shocked that nobody has gone back to just the basics of just watch the highlights, man. Mm. Watch the highlights, put some commentary, and that's all you need.
Mm. Interesting. I guess you would just need the rights to all the footage, right?
Yeah, I mean, you got to sort out all the details and all
Sorry,
that.
Sorry, I'm a lawyer. I'm like, how could you go about doing that? What agreements would you need? So sorry about that.
It's funny we're kind of getting off topic on this last one, but who cares? The NBA is actually very lenient with their copyright. I'm not saying you could do that without penalty.
If you
use their clips on YouTube or anywhere else,
they will
put a copyright infringement notice on you.
Yeah.
But they will not penalize you.
Yeah.
Like, it's I not like your account will get banned or anything like that.
Yeah. I think they're like attempting for like viral marketing of some kind. And so deliberate decision to do that.
Exactly. Yeah. Which is the opposite of Major League Baseball, which really messed up on this front a couple of years back.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm glad. I mean, I want to be able to watch highlights whenever I want. And I know there are some fantastic Raptors fans who use the highlights to put together great commentary, and then there's a lot to learn. Yeah. Right now I'm thinking of Too Much Hoops and the defensive breakdowns that they do. It's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Well, Sarah, thank you for coming on and talking to me for the last little bit. We hope to have you back, hopefully on one of these shows, or maybe on a post-game live stream that we might do after one of these games in the next couple of weeks. Once again, thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun. I'm really honored to be here.